This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, this poet never gets old. I think we're going to hear a lot more about John Keats. In the spring of 1819, almost 200 years ago, the young English Romantic poet wrote his six famous odes, Ode to a Grecian Urn, Ode to Indolence, Ode to Melancholy, Ode to a Nightingale, and Ode to Psyche. It remains one of the greatest explosions of lyric genius in literary history. Keats was only 24, and he would die a year later. On this podcast, we're going to hear some shorter poems Keats wrote, and I'm joined by Benjamin Voigt. Ben wrote a primer for our website, John Keats 101, it's called, and he joins me now from Macalester College, where he teaches. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
So, John Keats is one of the most famous poets in the English language. He probably ranks right up close to Shakespeare. But I have an awkward question to put to you.
Oh, boy.
In 2018, with our world in crisis, ecologically and politically, why should we read John Keats? Make the case for reading him today, if you would.
The case for Keats.
Yeah.
I think there are many reasons to read them, namely just sort of his absorption by the culture. It means that his sort of ideas and sort of romanticism's kind of influence in general is just everywhere.
Yeah.
But in particular, I think his idea of negative capability comes up a lot in sort of poetic discourse, but also sort of more broad cultural ones.
It comes up everywhere. I've seen it in political discussions. It just pops up regularly these days. Negative capability. Explain what it is a bit for us.
So I actually have the letter here where he sort of defines it. And it's a funny term because it is so broadly sort of used now, but he kind of just coined it in passing in a letter to his brothers.
Huh.
It's just like basically a sentence in that letter that's been taken up in all kinds of ways. So if you'll allow me, I'll read that and then can talk about it a little bit too.
Yeah.
In this letter, he's talking about a conversation, a disquisition that he had with a friend of his, and he talks about several things dovetailing in his mind, and then is struck by this idea. The quality that went to form a man of achievement, especially in literature, in which Shakespeare possessed so enormously. I mean negative capability. That is when man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason.
Hmm.
We live in a time of tons of uncertainty, serious uncertainty about, you know, politics, sort of ecology. And so the capability of kind of living in that condition, not sort of succumbing to it and not sort of presupposing our kind of own ideas about what those uncertainties might be without sort of resorting to political rhetoric, without leaning on old ideas, received ideas of different kinds, rather sort of being receptive to the challenges, the doubts, the mysteries that he's talking about here, and sort of sorting through them, sitting with them, and in poetry, sort of dealing with their sort of emotional aspect.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems poetry is the perfect vehicle for negative capability of holding a lot of things in one's mind at the same time. A lot of ambiguities, a lot of double meanings, a lot of feelings all packed into the same verbal space. And it seems to me also that reading poetry can be a good way to train the mind in negative capability, no?
I think that's definitely true. In the poems that we're going to look at today, two sonnets,
mm-hmm.
You see him sort of meditating on things that are sort of concerning to him, mortality and art in different ways.
Let's get to one of them. This is a sonnet called On Seeing the Elgin Marbles. And Ben, the Elgin Marbles from the ancient Parthenon in Athens now sit in the British Museum. But when Keats first saw them, they had just been brought to England by Thomas Bruce, 7th Earl of Elgin.
That's correct. And he went and visited them at least once, I think maybe several times, with his friend, the painter Benjamin Haydon.
So it was a big deal when these marbles mm-hmm. arrived in England, and they were just freshly arrived. That's a bit of background to the writing of this sonnet, but the sonnet itself barely refers to the Elgin Marbles, except in the title. What else would be good to know before we hear it?
So he wrote this poem in 1817, I believe. It was sort of on the earlier end of his, you know, admittedly very short career.
Right.
I don't think he himself was ill at the time, but he was someone who'd always been sort of worried about his own mortality, maybe in part because of his sort of family history. His father died when he was very young. Mm. His mother died when he was young. He cared for people who had tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. Death was more of a part of everyday life. And so I think that is probably informing this poem, though, of course, as contemporary readers, we're sort of looking for sort of signs of his own understanding of his own demise or something like that.
Yeah, that's kind of irresistible from our point of view. Let's hear it. Our reader here in the studio with me is Cindy Katz.
My spirit is too weak. Mortality weighs heavily on me like unwilling sleep. And each imagined pinnacle and steep of godlike hardship tells me I must die, like a sick eagle looking at the sky. Yet 'tis a gentle luxury to weep that I have not the cloudy winds to keep fresh for the opening of the morning's eye. Such dim-conceived glories of the brain bring round the heart an undescribable feud. So do these wonders a most dizzy pain that mingles Grecian grandeur with the rude wasting of old time, with a billowy mane, a sun, a shadow of a magnitude.
That was On Seeing the Elgin Marbles. And I'd like to go through this very short poem bit by bit. Cindy, can you read the first five lines again?
My spirit is too weak. Mortality weighs heavily on me like unwilling sleep. And each imagined pinnacle and steep of godlike hardship tells me I must die, like a sick eagle looking at the sky.
So, Ben, the poet announces he's either sick or he's fearing his own death and feeling his oncoming death, like sleep coming on. But what does he mean when he says, each imagined pinnacle and steep of godlike hardship tells me I must die, like a sick eagle looking at the sky? How do you read that?
So it's a strange series of lines that add up to kind of complex image, and we end on like a sick eagle looking at the sky, which apparently originates in a belief held at the time that eagles could look at the sun directly without it doing them any damage or something like that. But I think there's sort of contemporary echoes of eagle eyes being sort of keen. Though he's a sort of sick eagle, and of course, again, we're going to sort of this retrospective look at him. We're going to think about his own sickness, and the sickness of his family or whatnot. But I think we can read it less literally than that and take sort of more from it that he's looking at this sculptural frieze, right? This thing made of sort of marble. He's seeing a topographical map of hardship in his life to come, and a sort of reminder that he's not going to survive it a certain way.
Yeah, that's an odd response to the Elgin Marbles, I have to say. But perhaps because they are so ancient and the people they are modeled on are all dead, it gives him a feeling of mortality. It's unclear why he has a strong sense of mortality from the images of the Elgin Marbles.
Yeah, it's true. It's a strange response, and he describes it later in the poem. Can we go to later?
Yeah, let's go to the next three lines. Cindy, can you read this? It's one full sentence.
Yet 'tis a gentle luxury to weep that I have not the cloudy winds to keep fresh for the opening of the morning's eye.
So the morning's eye seems to be the sun, right? And he's comparing himself to the eagle.
He's comparing himself to the eagle or comparing himself to, the sky itself, that he doesn't feel as sort of fresh as he would like to be. He says it's a gentle luxury to weep that we have that yet. That's sort of like turning the argument a little bit. He feels too weak, but it's a sort of luxury of his to sort of imagine this coming hardship and his sort of mortality.
Let's hear the last six lines of the poem where he basically puts the conflict right in front of us, his internal conflict right in front of us.
Such dim-conceived glories of the brain bring round the heart an undescribable feud. So do these wonders a most dizzy pain that mingles Grecian grandeur with the rude wasting of old time, with a billowy mane, a sun, a shadow of a magnitude.
Now, I have to confess that I lose the thread of this poem in those last six lines, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to explain it a little bit to me, Ben.
The brain and the heart are sort of in conflict here. The brain, I see that, you know, he knows that he's going to die, and the heart is the sort of position, well, I don't want to die. I don't want to imagine myself in this sort of vertiginous way, this dizzy way of being a historical subject bound to time that's temporal, that is not going to last. And that's where I see the sort of central conflict of the poem, that undescribable feud being that knowledge of one's own death brought about by looking at something that's very old and very grand, that how can I sort of measure up to this ancient thing, this sort of like alien object, when, you know, I have to deal with, as he puts it here, the rude wasting of old time.
Ben, we talked about negative capability a few minutes ago. How would you identify the negative capability in this poem on seeing the Elgin marbles?
Negative capability in this poem, I think, is his attempt to navigate the sort of undescribable feud, to reckon with that dizzy pain. His mortality that he understands in a new way upon seeing these ancient marble friezes. And I think this poem is an interesting one because it doesn't reach after some sort of neat, tidy meaning, some sort of conclusion. In fact, it does quite the opposite. It sort of crumbles at the end. It turns into a list of images that might express the sort of vastness of historical time, of the poet's or the eye's inability to understand the sublime.
So do these wonders a most dizzy pain that mingles Grecian grandeur with the rude wasting of old time, with a billowy mane, a sun, a shadow of a magnitude.
You know, he describes negative capability as capability of not engaging in that, what he calls, irritable reaching after fact and reason. This is a poem that where it's about expressing a certain amount of feeling and like thinking about that feeling, articulating that feeling, but not trying to dispel it necessarily.
Let's turn now to another sonnet, which may have been the last poem Keats ever wrote. It's called Bright Star. What can you tell us about this poem, Ben?
It's also one that is thinking a lot about mortality, though in a sort of less abstract way, less about one's individual relationship with the broad sort of sweep of time or one's sort of capacity to make a lasting impression on history, and more about mortality in terms of love and desire and the interest in sort of staying on Earth in a relationship.
Give us a little biographical context to this poem, since this was the probably the last poem he ever wrote. What was going on at this time?
So there's some kind of debate among scholars, for what I recall, about when the poem was written, 1818, 1819, somewhere in there. It could be could be one of these last poems that he wrote. But this is more towards the end of his life, closer to it anyway, and when he was probably thinking about mortality in a more personal biographical way.
Yeah, he had tuberculosis and he probably saw that he was going to die of it. All right, let's hear it. Cindy?
Bright star, would I were steadfast as thou art, not in lone splendor hung aloft the night and watching with eternal lids apart, like nature's patient, sleepless eremite, the moving waters at their priest-like task of pure ablution round earth's human shores, or gazing on the new soft-fallen mask of snow upon the mountains and the moors? No, yet still steadfast, still unchangeable, pillowed upon my fair love's ripening breast, to feel forever its soft fall and swell, awake forever in a sweet unrest, still, still to hear her tender taken breath, and so live ever, or else swoon to death.
So Ben, there's the duality of two things held in opposition in that last line, to live forever or swoon to death. And it's kind of a hackneyed rhyme, death and breath, but it works, I think, especially when you consider that John Keats had tuberculosis.
Yeah, and it's a surprise, second half of that line, a sort of surprise thing to rhyme with, because up until that point, as you sort of observed in the poem, it's sort of been about steadfastness, right? And then suddenly we have a swooning to death at the end. Maybe that's one of the ways in which it earns that rhyme.
So getting back to this idea of negative capability, where do you see it in Bright Star, in this poem?
I see it as him sort of holding or thinking through what it would mean to be steadfast, right? To be unchangeable. He starts there. He, for this wish that he's sort of addressing to something unchangeable, the North Star maybe. And then kind of realizing, well, no, I don't want to be all of the things associated with that steadfastness. I don't want to be alone. That a certain amount of steadfastness, unchangeableness would require that in certain ways, would require a hermit-like life or a priest-like devotion to purity and apartness in some ways. Being eternal would leave you alone in some ways. He decides that he doesn't want certain aspects of that, but would still like to be sort of enduring, because it would mean that he would get to stay here on earth alongside his beloved in the poem, the her of the poem, possibly Fanny Braun. And so he's sort of thinking through, like, what does it mean to be with someone, to be in a sort of romance when that romance is necessarily going to end. So he's sort of wrestling with this throughout the poem. And I think he sort of finally, through the poem perhaps, leads to a certain amount of acceptance of the possibility of death.
Still to hear her tender taken breath, and so live ever, or else swoon to death.
And that last line, and so live ever or else swoon to death, those two very different things, that's a demonstration of negative capability in one line, I would say.
Yeah, it has this dash, this sort of midline pause that kind of gives them sort of equal weight. And I think he finally permits that idea of death to sort of enter the poem explicitly, though it's been in the sort of background of it the whole time, because he sort of imagined some of the costs of being eternal and what he'd sort of miss out on if he really were like this bright star, if he really were that distant. You can't have one without the other, he sort of thinks, I think, in this poem.
Mm-hmm. So Bright Star was the name of a movie about Keats by Jane Campion a few years ago. Did anybody see this?
I did, but it's been a long time.
I actually saw it fairly recently.
Cindy, you saw it recently?
I happened to, yeah.
Yeah, really? And I haven't seen it. Ben, what did you think of it?
I enjoyed it, but I think I saw it when it came out, which is some time ago.
And Cindy? More recently?
A lot of time with film. It's where you are when you come to it. I was quite bored, I must say.
Oh, no.
It's a problem with, it's romantic, it's beautiful, but when the poets in film are always so anemic and kind of wimpy.
Yeah, poets don't come off in film very, very, very well, I think, in general. So, and somebody is as archetypal as John Keats, I think that's quite a daring thing to take on. Okay, I said we weren't going to go into the odes, but several years ago, we recorded the actor Michael Stuhlbarg reading Ode on a Grecian Urn, and I thought we'd go out on that without commentary. So, Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
Now here's Michael Stuhlbarg reading Ode on a Grecian Urn by John Keats.
Thou still unravished bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time, sylvan historian, who canst thus express a flowery tale more sweetly than our rhyme, what leaf-fringed legend haunts about thy shape, of deities or mortals or of both, in Tempe or the dales of Arcady? What men or gods are these? What maidens loathe, what mad pursuit, what struggle to escape, what pipes and timbrels, what wild ecstasy. heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Therefore, ye soft pipes, play on. Not to the sensual ear, but more endeared, pipe to the spirit ditties of no tone. Fair youth beneath the trees, thou canst not leave thy song, nor ever can those trees be bare. Bold lover, never, never canst thou kiss, though winning near the goal yet. Do not grieve. She cannot fade, though thou hast not thy bliss. Forever wilt thou love, and she be fair. Ah, happy, happy boughs, that cannot shed your leaves, nor ever bid the spring adieu. And happy melodist, unwearied, forever piping songs, forever new. More happy love, more happy, happy love, forever warm and still to be enjoyed, forever panting and forever young, all breathing human passion far above, that leaves a heart high, sorrowful, and cloyed, a burning forehead and a parching tongue. Who are these coming to the sacrifice? To what green altar, O mysterious priest, leadest thou that heifer lowing at the skies, and all her silken flanks with garlands dressed? What little town by river or seashore or mountain built with peaceful citadel is emptied of this folk, this pious morn? And little town thy streets forevermore will silent be, and not a soul to tell why thou art desolate can e'er return. O Attic shape, fair attitude, with breed of marble men and maidens overwrought, with forest branches and the trodden weed, thou, silent form, dost tease us out of thought, as doth eternity, cold pastoral. When old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain, in midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man, to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. That is all ye know on earth, and all ye need to know.
That was Ode on a Grecian Urn by John Keats, read by Michael Stuhlbarg. You can read Benjamin Voigt's John Keats 101 on our website, where you'll find other primers he's written and thousands of poems. We love getting emails with your comments and suggestions. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.